Thursday afternoon. 70 degrees on the outside. Near perfect weather. And we're actually a couple of degrees better than AccuWeather promised. And it doesn't get much better than that. Clear skies and going to be nice for a couple of days. Temperatures in the low 70s through Thursday. We'll talk to AccuWeather coming up at 3:35, and we'll find out how much further that nice weather goes on out into the future. But at least through Thursday is set up and looks like it's going to be good days in a row. Well, we talked to Karima El Amin last week about what the food pantries of the state are taking what they're looking at as the government is shut down. And well, good afternoon, Karima. How are you?
Good afternoon to you. I'm wonderful, considering.
Yeah. Did we lose WIC yesterday? It seemed that was the day WIC was going to run out of money.
Well, the WIC was lost across the country in other states. Fortunately for Michigan, we had some reserves, so they expect WIC to be able to last about another 4 to 5 weeks. After that, they won't have anything left in their reserves. So this is coming from reserves from that particular, our state's reserves for a WIC program. So that says a lot about Michiganders and the way we do things here.
Yeah, that's some good news in a otherwise ugly environment. Do you have, first off, you're from the Food Bank Council of Michigan, and you're an umbrella group of all sorts of pantries.
Yes, we're the statewide organizing body for all the Emergency Food Network in the state of Michigan. We are in all 83 counties. We have 7 regional food banks, 4 distribution sites, and over 3,200 members in our pantry network. And so that could be your local church, soup kitchen, community kitchen, all of those different individuals that are organizations that plug into the food banking system. However, there are still plenty more pantries and neighborhood kitchens that not utilize the food bank system, but we are the largest by far.
Sure. Now that we've had the government shut down for over a week, are you beginning to get your arms around the impact that the federal government shutdown is going to have on supplying food to poor people?
Well, yes, we have. We've been in discussions, as you can imagine, about what we would do. Particularly, we were concerned about the WIC program. And what we've come to understand is that we're going to do what we've always done. However, if the federal government stops the ability for us to draw down TFAP, which is the bread and butter of the emergency food system, the emergency food assistance program where we get our commodities, it will have to force the food banks to start going into our cash reserves, particularly like a program like what, let's say that the shutdown went on another 4 weeks or so, and the reserves are ran out of through the state of Michigan. Since we don't get formula and the type of foodstuffs for children on a consistent, large enough basis, we would have to actually go and purchase that product. And truthfully, we could purchase it cheaper because we buy at an impact, but we would have to go in our food bank regions individually to the food banks and ask them to go into their reserves in order to purchase the products that they would need to be able to supplement the loss we will see for a WIC program was to go.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm hearing is so far, so good. Michigan had reserves for the WIC program, and so far the delivery system for food for hungry people is not being negatively impacted yet.
Well, there hasn't been for the WIC, but we do believe that we will start to see, because the thing about a shutdown like this, you don't immediately see the effects, because as individuals, those people, as I talked about over the last time we spoke, are on the fringe. You're already the lower page workers who are already, you know, having difficulties making ends meet week to week or check to check. If they do have to take a furlough, if they do have to be out work for even a week, we will have to supplant the food that we would normally have for those people that we're already serving to serve additional families, which we would do. However, over the long haul, 6 months to a year, we will still see the effects of those dollars that we had to expend with the influx of people that we weren't counting on. And not that we ever can, you know, with the system totally to this point, know how many people we serve, but we have a really good guesstimate, if I would say, of how many people we will be serving. But when that increases, we do have to think about how we're going to get more food in, and also the frequency and the quickness that we need to get it into the food banks to assure that we meet the need.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen an influx of new clientele, people who have been furloughed from the government, the federal government?
I think what we've seen thus far is a little panic from people who know if they have to, they're trying to come in sooner. But we won't know. It'll still be even a few more weeks, because you have to imagine that most people don't come to the food banks because they want to. They come if they really absolutely have to. So for some people, they may have a little to last maybe a week or so. And then after that, they have to start making those tough decisions on, okay, I need to get groceries, but I need to pay my rent. I need to get groceries, but I have to pay my car note. And then that's what we're going to see in a few weeks, those things to start to affect families. And for some families, those are the decisions that they have to make right now that can put them behind for several months.
I really appreciate your giving us an update, and I will, in fact, invite you back as things move on here to keep track of this. The food pantries at some point are going to be stressed. And
absolutely.
And I want everybody to know when that happens.
Way that they can help now,
okay.
If you just let me add that we're in the middle of our Michigan Harvest Gathering, which is the largest statewide food and fund drive in the state. This is our 23rd year. We started it 23 years ago with Attorney General Bill Schuette and his wife. And if people want to donate, it's like pay it forward, and they can go to www.feedmichigan.org and donate dollars to help us to be ensure that we have the monies available when we need them.
Thank you for the work you do. I appreciate it. It's important work. And we will be talking to you in the future for an update.
Okay, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You betcha. Karima El-Amin, one of the people trying to make sure there aren't lots of hungry people in Michigan. Putting on a different hat, we have Amy Harden joining us. Amy is, she was originally going to be here yesterday, but who knew we were still playing baseball in October. And Amy, how you doing this afternoon?
I am just fine. Thank you, Roger.
And I wanted to talk to you about your blog from Friday. It's still something I find interesting, even though we had to postpone our visit. The title pretty much says it all. RTW, or Right to Work, is a flaming flop with the MEA. Before we go any further, how about explaining that headline?
Yes, and I have a wonderful graphic to go with it that I won't describe here. They'll have to go to my website to see that.
And it's not me. That is not me.
No, it's not at all.
I don't have a beard.
No, definitely. And you wouldn't wear that T-shirt either. Basically, what happened was public education in Michigan has taken a double whammy from the Michigan legislature, the GOP, in the form of, first off, Right to Work, which affects all union workers. And the second thing that was specific to teachers, to union members, is The legislature passed a law saying that they can't even automatically deduct their dues from their paycheck, even on a voluntary basis. So they don't even get the rights that, for example, United Way would have under the law. So that's a double whammy, and everyone expected this, that the MEA, the Michigan Education Association, would take a really big hit on that from teachers not paying their dues. Well, the president of the MEA, Steve Cook, announced last Friday morning that it's only a 1% that are not paying their dues. That's 1,500 people out of 150,000 across the state. And I'd like to put those numbers into some context that really, really tell the tale. I mean, is it first off that 99% of any group of people would pay their bill or, you know, pay something that they, you know, might owe is quite astounding to begin with. But let's look at the political makeup of the MEA. It's difficult to pen down that particular the particular numbers on that because there's quite a few surveys and studies, and people may not be completely honest as to what political stripe they are. They might call themselves independents more often just to take the safe road. But a 2003 National Education Survey found that 51% are Democrats, 25% Republican, and 24% Independent. So that's really telling that people are willing to choose their union affiliation and the value that that brings them over their political affiliation. Another thing is that the amount of these dues, people don't know what that is. I didn't even know what it was until I did a little research into it. For the Michigan Education Association, their current dues are 1.5% of last year's income with a cap of $635 per year. Now, teachers, their beginning salary in Michigan, an average, and this is from a few years ago because I don't have updated, I don't think there are any updated averages out there to be had at this point. Beginning salary average across the state is $34,100. Average salary across the board for public sector teachers in Michigan, $55,541. Let's compare that to lawmakers, the people that have put this burden on the teachers and just keep cutting and cutting and hitting them with one law after another that either cuts funding to education itself or makes it more difficult for them to teach to begin with. Lawmakers earn currently $71,685 per year plus generous benefits, including a $10,800 expense account. And on top of that, then they get an account for their staffing and for their transportation. Whereas school teachers, the National School Supply and Equipment Association did a survey of teachers to find out how many of them pay out of pocket for their expenses in the classroom, for schoolroom supplies and so forth. And they found that almost 100% did. They came up with 99.5% did, paying an average of $485 per teacher out of pocket to get their classroom going with supplies and so forth, monies that they're being starved of by the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very telling to me, too.
Mm-hmm. But since you brought that up, talk to me about Senate bills 89 and 90 and 142 and 143.
Oh, okay. Yes. And those along with a number of other bills. What's happening is when the legislature, they're trying to cut taxes. That's the GOP drive, you know, across the nation.
No, of course.
Across the nation. Our legislature is not unique in that regard when it's you know, Tea Party driven. And so they're cutting sales taxes on various things. I've got a list of them here. And these are this is pending legislation. One was just introduced by Lisa Posthumous Lyons, who is the chair of the House Committee on Education,
mm-hmm.
and her piece of legislation that she sponsored was to cut to eliminate taxes on prescriptions. So that's kind of out of her area of expertise, but nonetheless, she did that. There's also one to cut the taxes on trade-in vehicles, on pre-written software, on aviation fuel, and then also on prevent paying of millages on foreclosed property. When you add up, all of these bills are analyzed by the House Fiscal Analysis Team, and they figure out what the impact is going to be across the state and to particular areas, for example, public education. And if you add up all of these bills, it is yet another legislative assault on public education because it would eliminate $252 million total from our public education fund.
Well, let's focus for just a moment on the removing sales tax from aviation fuel. Do you know anything on the background of that? I don't buy much aviation fuel personally. My jet is parked permanently. Why would we remove the sales tax on aviation fuel?
Well, I imagine we would find a lobbying group behind that particular piece of legislation. I did not investigate who sponsored it and who had funded their campaign, but I suspect we would find some sort of a transportation lobbying group involved in that one, along with these others. You know, some of them, they sound perfectly reasonable to eliminate taxes on prescriptions. Prescriptions are a very high cost.
Yeah.
But still, we have to understand that education is mandatory in Michigan, and to create a situation where local units of government, school districts, have to educate children to a certain level and then to, you know, say what those levels are and then to underfund it, it's more or less an unfunded mandate, which is against the Michigan Constitution. They have to fully fund it one way or another, and they just keep on wearing away, eroding the funding for public education.
Yeah. Well, and clearly that's been a conservative goal for some time, is to go after public education. And these bills appear to me to be a backdoor approach to doing that, where it isn't directly linked to cutting education. Oh, we're just cutting the sales tax on aviation fuel. And there's not an easy direct line to see how that really is going after the school funding. And all of these bills you mentioned end up reducing the amount of money going to schools.
That is true. And the rationale behind this, that the what they're trying to accomplish, I think, is a more privatization of public education and to have more of it go online, because that can be done not only on the cheap and very poorly, I might add, but it also feeds into their capitalistic model of, you know, that someone should be making money off of this, basically, you know, make it like our healthcare system as it has been and hopefully won't continue to be.
Yeah.
The other thing behind the attack on public educators in Michigan, on the MEA in particular, is, and Steve Cook, the president of the MEA, you know, said this very clearly, that it was retaliation for their activism and fighting against right-wing public education, anti-public education agenda, and for the recall of Representative Paul Scott, who had previously been the House Committee on Education chair.
Interesting. Political retribution is somewhere involved in this versus actually being concerned about educating our young people. I appreciate your joining us this afternoon, Amy. It's always good to talk with you. If people would like to read your thoughts directly, how would they do that?
They can go to my website, democracy-tree.com, and there they can find me on Facebook and on Twitter. And in another hour or so here, I'm going to put up a post that will have even more expanded numbers and some in-depth studies on what has happened in Michigan public education that I'd like to share.
Well, we'll be looking forward to that for evening reading. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you, Roger.
Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.
Amy Harden, the author of Democracy Tree. At 590, WKZO. 71 degrees out there. Beautiful weather for October. Coming up in just a few seconds, an update from CBS. We'll find out what President Obama had to say in his press conference earlier this afternoon. Following that, an update from the WKZO.com newsroom and the Wall Street Journal report, and then we'll talk to AccuWeather. All of that ahead on 590 WKZO Kalamazoo. CBS News. Degrees out there. Nice day. And we'll give Dave Samuels from AccuWeather complete credit for that. Hi, Dave. How you doing?
Hi. Good. Glad to take credit for it. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, if you call in January, we'll blame you for stuff at that point.
I'll make sure not to be on the schedule then.
Yeah. This will all even out.
Yeah, it will.
Got a word for the day for us.
Yeah. It kind of goes along with those 70s out there. I'm going to call it Hot-tober, if I could say it.
Yeah.
Hot-tober. Right.
How hot is it going to be?
Well, we're going to be in the 70s the rest of the week. I mean, we're already running almost 10 above normal for the month, and I don't see anything but 70s in the forecast right through the end of the week and even the weekend. So, yeah, we're looking good.
What do we owe this beautiful weather to?
You know, a lot of times we get stuck in a pattern here, and we're in a setup where the weather pattern isn't changing much across the country. Everything's kind of blocked up. The jet stream's not really that active to kind of push things along. So there's going to be a big storm sitting on the southeast coast and another big storm in the Rockies. So we're kind of in between those systems, and we got a high pressure overhead, and it's not going anywhere, at least right through the weekend.
The storm in the southeast, what's going on with that? It never turned into even the minimal hurricane that had been predicted.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it completely dissipated as far as a tropical system goes. Now, there's still a low pressure out there, and what's left of that low pressure is out over the Gulf Stream right now, and it's actually trying to strengthen, but it's basically just going to be a normal storm system for the East Coast, but a pretty gusty one at that. There's going to be some gale force winds with it, but doesn't look like it will be anything tropical to worry about.
Any chance of the cold weather you mentioned to the west getting here? There was even snow involved in that one.
Oh, yeah. It was an amazing snowstorm from Wyoming into South Dakota. You know, snow up to the roofs of people's houses, and you got all the leaves on the trees out there. So it was a disaster. Lots and lots of power outages. But that cold air is just going to hit a roadblock as it tries to come eastward, and it's not going to really be able to penetrate into the Great Lakes region at all, at least for the next week, it looks like. So might see some pattern changes by November, but it may take until then.
I've got a quick question for you.
Sure.
Before I let you go. And this is an entomology question.
Uh-oh.
saw a woolly bear caterpillar today that was all black. What does that mean as far as wives' tales for winter?
That's a good question. I am not 100% sure about that. I know it has to do with the color of what the season's going to hold for us. So I'll have to get back to you on that one.
Okay. Okay. Maybe one of our listeners knows.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm not certain of that either. Will you be back again with us tomorrow, Dave?
I sure will be tomorrow and Thursday as well.
Good deal. We'll talk to you then.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Mm-hmm.
Or Bob. Dave Samuels. I'm constantly got Bob on my mind. He's a regular part of the show. How's Michael this afternoon, by the way?
Oh, I'm doing quite well.
Good. Michael is in master control, taking care of everything, keeping me out of trouble, and that's nearly a full-time job. Joining us now is Jill Fritz. Jill is the Michigan Director for the Humane Society of the United States. And Jill, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm just fine. Give us your impression of the beginning of wolf hunting license sales. Was demand what had been predicted?
Well, that's hard to say, really. That's only something the DNR could answer, because they are the ones who advertised the licenses going on sale and were there at the places where they were selling the licenses. But I can tell you that our volunteers who were out all over the state collecting signatures on that day and collecting 43 signatures for each of the 43 wolves that were going to be killed in the upcoming season, their encounters with the public was they found that the public were just horrified that licenses were going on sale for this species that had just recently been removed from the endangered species list.
I had a friend of mine who's involved in wolf protection. It explained to me the massive number of wolf permits that were sold in Montana was actually related to how unpopular wolf hunting was. I have to admit the logic escaped me. Can you put that into perspective, or is the logic behind that a mystery to you as well?
Well, it is a mystery why anyone would want to buy a license to go out and hunt dogs. Basically, that's what you're doing. You're hunting wild dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And hunt one that there are so few of, and their species is still recovering and still so fragile. And for the most part, are not doing anybody any harm. And that can be already controlled through legal methods in the rare cases where there are conflicts with livestock or other animals. But I can tell you that the Minnesota DNR announced recently that they've seen a remarkable decrease in interest in hunting license sales for their upcoming season. And they speculated that it was a lot to do with novelty, that they had their first season last year, killed more than 400 wolves with horrible methods, strangling, snare traps, baiting, shooting, steel jaw leg hold traps. And people bought a lot of licenses that year. But this year, there are a lot fewer licenses being sold, and the interest is far down. And they think it was because just the novelty of getting your chance to shoot a wolf for the first time, and that wore off quickly. And now they're not seeing that interest this year.
Well, hopefully we will encounter that in Michigan. When does the actual wolf hunting season begin?
On November 15th, at deer season time, too. So there will be 1,200 licensed hunters up there in the three management zones out there gunning for 43 wolves.
And is the Humane Society comfortable that the state has an infrastructure in place to manage this hunt and to assure that no more than the allocated numbers of wolves are actually killed?
Well, that's their job, and presumably, yes, they should be able to manage that if they have managed any other kind of hunting seasons. And in Minnesota and Wisconsin, really the only precedent we've seen for these types of hunts here in the Midwest, they did keep the quota to within a couple of wolves. Of course, that's a couple too many, but they did not go over by many at all. So there's no reason to think that the Michigan DNR would also not be able to manage it within the expected quota.
Okay, good. We're talking with Jill Fritz, the state director for the Humane Society of the United States. Jill, how are we doing on the numbers of signatures required to let the people of the state still be involved in hunting decisions for the state?
We're doing very well. The public is extremely enthusiastic and supportive everywhere we go. I was just talking to our volunteer up in Marquette, one of our many volunteers in Marquette, as a matter of fact, out collecting signatures in front of the library, and she said they do very well there and all over the state. I just heard from somebody in Sault Ste. Marie earlier today who's doing very well. Whether it's St. Joseph or Kalamazoo or Detroit or Traverse City, where I was this weekend, We are collecting signatures at a very high rate, and we are right on track for our goals for the second referendum.
Great. And when is the deadline for collecting signatures?
We're asking everyone to turn them in on March 5th, 2014. Then they'll go to the Secretary of State, and when they're qualified, it will put the referendum of Public Act 21 on the November 2014 ballot, where we'll need citizens to vote down both that bill, giving the NRC the authority to designate game, and also need to vote down that first referendum making the wolf a game species, at which point Michigan's wolves will return to protected status and could no longer be hunted. But we have to make sure to vote down those both of those bills.
Sure. At this point, are you comfortable that you're on a trajectory that would get the required number of signatures?
Yes, I absolutely believe that we will get more than the required amount of signatures. But the weather is turning, and we've enjoyed some wonderful summer and fall weather so far, but it's going to get cold soon. So we're asking our volunteers to really pick up the pace and try to get as many as they can before we go back to how we were in the first referendum effort, standing out there freezing our fingers and toes off. So we encourage everyone, if they are interested in joining our campaign, visit keepwolvesprotected.com to sign up to be a signature collector.
Always good talking with you, Jill, and we'll have you back on periodically for updates.
Absolutely.
On how many signatures we've garnered. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jill. Jill Fritz, the director of Michigan for the Humane Society of the United States. 71 degrees in Kalamazoo. Let's find out what's going on. Five minutes to four. Raj Taylor driving you home on a Tuesday, and a nice day to drive home. Tigers don't play till Friday, right, Michael? Wait, there you go.
They play today.
Oh, they do?
Yep. Game time is 5:07. Pre-game is slated for around 4:40, 4:45-ish.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I thought the next game was Friday.
No.
Huh. See, this is why you're in there.
I can educate you.
And try to keep me straight.
Out of trouble.
Yeah. And so, you mean, there's actually going to be a ball game this afternoon before the end of the show?
Yeah, we're going to get cut off.
Really? Really?
Yeah.
Huh. I'm glad I know that. Is there another game Friday?
If the Tigers win, I believe their next game is going to be on Thursday. Yep, if they win, their next game will be Thursday out in Oakland, and that game would be at 9:07. So they have to win today to keep their season alive.
I just figured out why I'm so confused.
Oh, yeah.
I'm looking at our sheet here, and this is actually, if I looked at the date, I would have noticed October 4th. But I didn't notice the date. I just saw Friday at Oakland, 9:10.
We'll have to get after somebody to update that.
Well, at least I am not going to be reading that one anymore. So there's a game tonight.
Yep. They would have actually been playing at 8:30 tonight if the Red Sox had won last night against the Rays, but they get the 8:30 game. Tigers get the 5:07 game.
I see. Is that televised?
Yes, it's going to be on TBS.
Okay. Okay. And it's today.
It's today.
Prior to the end of this show.
Prior to the end of this show.
Okay. It's nice to know these things.
Yeah. Good thing I'm here keeping you up on top of things, right?
Yeah, yeah. Somebody's got to do it. Yeah. It's dirty work, but somebody's got to do it. Mostly sunny and milder today. That's the WKZO.com AccuWeather forecast. And the expected high, 68. We've exceeded that by 3 degrees. Clear and chilly tonight. Low of 42 in town, maybe upper 30s out in the countryside. Pleasant tomorrow, bright sunshine, 70. Thursday, mostly sunny. Nice afternoon, 72. And the weather forecast goes on like that. Ditto, ditto, ditto. Clear through the weekend, according to Dave Samuels. We can take this weather right up till Christmas.
Oh, yeah, I'll take this anytime.
And Christmas, the week between Christmas and New Year's, we could have some snow.
Mm-hmm.
Get the snow in time for Christmas Eve. And but then New Year's Day, it goes back to like this.
Yeah.
And sunny, 40s at night, 70s in the daytime.
Oh, it'd be so comfortable.
Yeah.
Could wear shorts all year round.
Yeah. But that's not going to happen. When I had Dave Samuels on the phone, I asked him about the woolly bear caterpillar I saw. Hello, listeners. We need some expertise. When you see a completely dark woolly bear caterpillar, what does that mean? 382-4280-877-382-4280.
I actually went and looked up that online, and basically it says the more red-orange, the warmer the winter's going to be, the less red-orange, the colder it's going to be. So this must be going to be a really cold winter if you saw an all-black one.
Yeah, there was no red on this thing at all.
Oh, boy.
After CBS News and Kalamazoo's news from the WKZO.com newsroom on 590 WKZO Kalamazoo.